2001 by Angela Wood. So let's get started. Do either of you want to go ahead and start about where you were born and what your family did?
I was born. Well, I'm not sure where I was born. I was born over at Lake Chelan, and we lived at a log house at First Creek, but we lived down in the coulee at a little house down there. And when I was younger, I probably would have known where I was born, and I could have asked my mother, but I didn't. I thought I knew, and then later on in my years, she says, "You were born at First Creek." The next time I asked her, "You was born in the coulee." So I'm not sure where I was born.
You don't remember where you were born.
One of his brothers, they know, was born in the coulee. Uh-huh. And then they moved to First Creek, and the third brother was born there, but he was born someplace between, and they don't know where.
And the house at First Creek was a log house, and it was built, probably third of the century, mm-hmm. and it had two stories, had upstairs and downstairs, and very, very beautiful, raised garden and everything there.
Mm-hmm. And your parents, what did they do for a living?
My mom came from Illinois to Lakeside when she was a little girl, mm-hmm. and my dad was born in Illinois, was it? And he came to the Sunnyside when he was 2 years old, and we have a picture of him in here when he came to Sunnyside. And they started a Christian community, and it was an invitational thing, and the only ones that they would invite were real Christians, mm-hmm. and they were
brethren.
And so that's how they came to Washington. Mm-hmm. And then from
your mother was a teacher.
Yeah, she taught school.
Where did she teach school at?
Well, she taught school up Lake Chelan. They had a couple communities up there, and it was too far for the kids to come down to Chelan to go to school, so she would go up there and teach. And she even taught in the wintertime, mm-hmm. and she lived in a tent, and she had to go down to the lake and carry water up to her tent, and the kids would come there to her tent and teach.
Oh,
and
wow.
A lot of times there'd be lots of snow. And
that would be so cold.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they had three different places on Lake, they had Lake Chelan, mm-hmm. and 1 year they would teach there so that the children could stay home, and the other years when they didn't have a teacher, then they had to go to Chelan to go to and board and go mm-hmm. to school there.
Mm-hmm. So how long, do you know how long she taught for?
She quit teaching when she got married, and she got married in 1919 is when she got married, and mm-hmm. she quit teaching then.
She taught up lake this 1 year, then she taught up in what was called Wells Coulee, mm-hmm. then, what, is it Navarre now?
Navarre Coulee.
It's called Navarre now, and she taught some of Earl's uncles, mm-hmm. and She taught at Winesap, which is a little town that doesn't exist anymore on the Columbia River, mm-hmm. right in that same area between Chelan and Wenatchee.
Mm-hmm. And then my grandparents moved their sawmill around to where the timber was, and it went out. Well, then because it was so expensive to try to, they didn't have any way to haul the lumber, the trucks. So anyway, they when they lived up on the hill, she taught up there too. My great granddad, grandparents lived up there in the hills, and they were farmers,
mm-hmm. sawmill people,
sawmill and farmers. Yeah.
So, is this the schools that she taught in? Were they just like community efforts?
Oh yeah.
You know, just mm-hmm. well, bare bones.
They were state approved.
They were state approved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Did they do you know if they got any state funding or anything, or was it just?
Oh, I'm sure they did. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's cool.
Because they were legitimate schools.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Were they a graded system or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Good. So your father?
My father worked in a sawmill, and he, in those days, there was a large family. There was six boys and one girl that lived. There were several of them that were stillborn or died young mm-hmm. because they didn't have medical or doctors or anything then. But there's only one left out of it, and it's an aunt that lives down in the San Francisco area, and she's 96
mm-hmm.
and still active, and talked to her the other day. Her doctor says she can't come up here anymore because she's had a, implant?
Pacemaker
put in, but she says she's going to come anyway. 96 years old.
Oh, that's neat. So he worked in a sawmill for.
He worked in a sawmill, and then when he got married, his dad gave him this place up at First Creek. That's what they gave him. They gave him land or something. So that's what he inherited, was that place up there, and we lived there until 1929, and the Depression hit. First Creek, the water dried up. He knew it was going to dry up, so there was a man named McKenzie up at Omak who had a restaurant. Well, restaurant business was pretty good. A lot of people wanted to eat. They had to eat.
Mm-hmm.
But with the Depression, a lot of them didn't have money. So he traded even up the orchard for their restaurant. Well, they both went broke because,
mm-hmm.
people late, but they couldn't pay their bills. So
he said it was one Scotchman trying out to another one.
Yeah. So anyway, then they moved from there. We moved back down to Lakeside and lived in a house down there close to where my grandparents lived. Their names was Weisberg and George and... what was her name?
Rebecca? No.
But anyway, they lived with my grandparents there.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's where I lived for a short time and went to school there at First Creek.
At
Lakeside in a little old school that isn't there anymore, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a little old wooden building. And
go ahead.
Then from there, we moved to... place called Ardenvore, and that's up the Antioch River, and there was a sawmill up there, and that's where my dad worked. My dad always was a small person, but very, very strong, and he pulled green chain, what they called, and that's where the lumber comes. When they saw the lumber, it comes down on a belt, and then you take the lumber, excuse me, and put it in piles. You had to push it up and push it up on piles, and somebody was up there receiving it, and then
uh-huh.
it would dry in great big piles.
Piles.
And that's what he did. He's a very, very strong person, and he did that. And then...
Manson?
We moved to Manson on Lake Chelan, and he worked in the sawmill there.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked so hard, he actually worked himself to death, is what he died of. But... He died in 1955, and he was 57 years old when he died.
Mm-hmm.
And he lived here. This is not the house he lived in.
Mm-hmm.
The one that was here was built by the around the turn of the century. This boathouse down here has that's the original boathouse was here with this place. We rebuilt, and it was built in... 1899 was when it was built. So we've rebuilt it, but we've left everything we could salvage off the old one and put it back up. And she and I did that ourselves. We built that. And then put the date on when we rebuilt it.
Now, the part you left out was the orchards at Manson.
Yeah, in those days you didn't have much money.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad wanted to raise apples because that's what we did at First Creek. So we went over to Manson and he bought 12 acres over there for $500. And that was all the money he had was $500. So he bought that. And then planted, there was some old orchard there, but they started planting new orchard.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, there wasn't the variety that they have now. They had wine saps and the old common delicious about the only apples that they had.
Mm-hmm.
So the orchard grew, and all of us kids worked at home and go to school. It was 3 miles downtown, and in the summertime we had to work in the orchard till about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and he'd let us walk downtown to go swimming. There's a swimming hole.
Mm-hmm.
So we walked 3 miles and swam and then came home and had supper. We ate 3 meals a day then. Breakfast was at 6 o'clock in the morning and ate at noon, and then 6 o'clock at night would be our evening meal. Mm-hmm. And they were very big meals. We raised our own beef, we raised chickens, pigs, turkeys, we raised everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember eating the pork. Our family all liked pork, and they'd butcher one of these great big pigs and then cut the great big slabs off of the hams, you know,
mm-hmm.
and take a meat saw, and we'd each get a steak that big around.
Oh my goodness.
And lots of, we had potatoes every meal. You know, that was something that we
mm-hmm.
had lots of, and lots of vegetables.
Lots of vegetables.
Yeah.
Did your mother keep a garden and stuff then?
Yeah, raised a nice garden in those days, mm-hmm. and I can remember tomatoes. When you're kids, there's things you don't like, and I remember I didn't like tomatoes.
I didn't like tomatoes when
don't
I was either. I like them now, but I didn't when I
yeah.
was
little. Let's see, we're at First Creek now.
No.
No, we're at
Manson.
At Manson. And Manson is lots and lots of memories.
Mm-hmm.
And we still go over there a lot. Her sister lives at Manson, so mm-hmm. we go over and see her a lot. And one of the kids that I went to school with, he and his wife, we go see them a lot. And we just had her 60th anniversary from graduating from high school.
No, I'm going to tell about that.
Okay, she'll tell about that. But anyway, we lived out on Loop Avenue. Now, we didn't have much money to build a house, so we went to the sawmill, the Gordon Sawmill, and we got rough lumber, and we were going to build a half a house, and then
the
other half, other half later, but come up like this and down, so it was just this half a house.
Uh-huh.
So we built a half a house, and it was just boards up and down, and we didn't have batting on it. And in the wintertime, you going to tell about that too? She can tell about
what happens
in the wintertime over there. It gets so cold, you know, that you had to have lots of covers on your bed because we didn't have any heat. The only heat we had was a cook stove in the kitchen. It was mm-hmm. a kitchen and then the rest of the house is all it was. And Mom and Dad had a bed here, and then us kids each had cots that we slept on.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a dog, and the dog used to sleep with us, and we don't always want the dog to sleep because he'd get down underneath the covers and he'd get
and
your feet warm.
Feet warm?
Yeah. And then we decided that we wanted to build a basement underneath the house.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'd work, you know, during the day, and then but we come to across a great big rock down underneath the house, and we just kept going around it, and it was probably 5 feet high, 6 feet long, great big rock, kind of a little flat on top.
So if you're building it from, if you're digging out the yeah. basement from on to underneath the house,
yeah.
how do you get the rock out?
All right, how do you get the rock out? Okay. There was a guy come through there. He was an insurance salesman.
Uh-huh.
My folks weren't there. And he says, how are you going to get that rock out there? We said, we didn't know. All we were doing was digging the basement. Let somebody else worry about that. So he says, well, if you got some pitch kindling, well, kindling pitch was wood that has a lot of the sap in it
mm-hmm.
that burns real. So he says, go get some pitch and some paper and a match. So we got, and he got the fire started up on top, and he kept throwing a little bit. Now, this is underneath the house, and we couldn't get it too big because it would
right.
melt. So we would just, and he says, just keep it going. Let it till you get ready to go to bed that night. So when the folks come home, they come home from work about 6 o'clock, and Dad says, what are you doing? I says, well, we're getting ready to take this rock out from underneath the house. Well, he didn't know. But anyway, the next morning when we woke up, the rock had
broken
because up. It has seams in it, it's got water in there, and the heat breaks.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that. It took, you know, 2 or 3 weeks for the bigger ones, so we get it down and take sledgehammers and break it up so we could
pull
it out. Throw it out. So mm-hmm. that's how we got the rock out of there.
It's pretty funny.
And there was hard pan down there, which you had to just practically, well, that house still is there, but I don't know. I never did stop to see what it looks like now because they've done a lot of their building and stuff around there.
Mm-hmm.
But the orchard and everything is there, but it's different trees than we had. Now, let's see, from there came World War II.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the only time I ever saw my dad cry. when us kids went off to services, two of us went together. And because, you know, terrible, terrible thing, these wars, and he thought, well, he'd probably never see us again.
Mm-hmm.
We joined, let's see, I can go back before that. We were, I worked at Boeing,
mm-hmm.
and helped build all the B-17E models that was built.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a B-17 up at Boeing, but it's a G model, which I didn't help build. But I've seen them fly, and so I worked at Boeing, and then I wanted to do something else, so I heard about they needed surveyors up in Yukon. They wanted to put a railroad from the United States to Alaska, because they figure if the Japanese come over and attack Alaska, well, we had to get stuff up there in a hurry.
Right.
So anyway, we started building this preliminary road for a railroad, and we had to go for less than a 2.5% grade, and sometimes we'd go up a ways and then have to come back. Now this is all walking, and sometimes we would get into an area where there'd be maybe a small town, maybe they'd have some pack horses that we could rent.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, we packed everything on our back. And we would pack up 16 miles and set up camp, survey back 8, and then up another 8, and then move 16 miles. My job was to carry the old cook stove on my back, so they'd take it and strip it down. Now this is like the old Majestic cook stove, and I'd turn up on my back and start up the trail with it. Well, they would let me stop and rest once in a while, but I would carry that thing up there. And
how much would one of those things weigh?
They were heavy.
Oh, I bet.
But when you're young, I had very, very strong legs. In fact, I was a very strong person.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so many memories of that trip. One time we'd moved, but there was one load of stuff left, and this is when we did have pack horses. A pack saddle is a wooden thing that fits over the back of a horse,
mm-hmm.
and you put the stuff on and then you tie it on. Well, I was going to go back down and get the last load, and we put a blanket on that thing for me to ride on so I didn't have to walk. Well, we were about halfway down, about 8 miles down here, and the trail goes by a big drop off. It's like a big cliff, and that's where the trail goes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I got going down there, and here's a bear that come up over the ridge. Well, the horses don't like bears, so
I can't imagine why.
We started to go back. Well, then the bear would come up over this way. So anyway, we got in front of it, and the horse started to run. Well, I couldn't get off the horse because I'd have gone over the bank.
Mm-hmm.
Well, by going like this, the blanket came out, and I was bouncing up and down on that pack saddle, and we got down to the bottom, and my bottom was raw.
No.
And I got off of that thing, and I've never been on a horse since. I've never ridden a horse since that time.
Oh, and that does not sound at all comfortable.
I guess one reason too, before that, why I lived on the farm, why when I was a kid, they used to put me up on the old horse and just let me ride, and my little old legs was rattled out, and I never really liked that, but everybody thought they all liked horses.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's see, that we had a lot of experience up there. We called on a little Salmon Lake was where we surveyed, and we got up and up the Macundy River, and we met another crew, and we ended up down in Watson Lake, and then we flew back to White Horse, and White Horse is where that narrow gauge railroad runs up through the canyon up in there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had gone up that thing to get up to go to surveying, but coming back we flew back down to White Horse, and then come on out by boat from there.
Mm-hmm.
They went into areas where white people had never been before.
Yeah, there was a few Indian villages. We saw places where they would smoke their salmon. They had them drying in the sun, and would smoke them and stuff like
that.
What was
their reaction upon seeing you?
They'd look at us.
Yeah.
They'd never seen a white man, but they'd look at us, and they didn't know, you know, they were sure peaceful. There was nothing
mm-hmm.
like that, but
just cautious.
Cautious, yeah. I always liked Indians. I kind of grew up with Indians, and I still like Indians. One thing, just this is just recently, but we belong to the Steilacoom tribe there in the church in Steilacoom, and Joan Ortiz is the person that's the tribal person, and then her son is chairman of the board and stuff like that, and we've been docents there for years, and she'd take one Saturday, and then I would take another Saturday a month, and what you do, you set up there, and people come to into the, it's a museum, and it's an upstairs and a downstairs, and the upstairs is just terrific of the things they have in there, the things you can read about the Indians and the tribes. And have you ever been in there?
I've been in there, but I haven't been upstairs.
Yeah, upstairs is where you should really look. I've got two things up there that I've donated from here, and one of them is called a breastplate, and it's something that the chiefs wore, and this is real Indian. It isn't anything that the white man made, and it's made out of bone, and it's got black bone and white bone. The black bone is buffalo horns, and that's put together with wire and things that and it goes around here. And if you ever see an Indian chief picture, the old ones, they had this breastplate on them. And
where did you end up acquiring something like that?
Well, things like this. Now, in our house, you can just find so many things because we've been ardent antique people and go to junk stores, antique shops. We've done this all of our life, and we've just spent hours and hours. Well, this one I found over in Wenatchee. Some Indian brought this breastplate in, needed some money, and sold it for a very little bit of money. Well, I saw it, knew what it was, so when he left, I asked this lady, I said, I'd like to buy that. And she said, well, I haven't even got it listed. I said, well, usually the antique dealers charge twice what they pay for it. I said, I'll give you twice. So she did, and so I bought it. And
very neat.
Let's see, what else did we give them?
The beaded gloves.
Oh yeah, beaded gloves. I had a pair of
beautiful old
beaded gloves. They're made out of deer hide, and the tops are just beaded, and everything is just beautifully beaded gloves. So I presented those to them too. So over there now, if you go in there, you'll find the gloves and the breastplate.
And then the stone that's from McNeil. They've got it labeled. It's from Anderson Island because we are, but it came from McNeil.
They had a mortar and pestle made out of rocks. Well, we used to find a lot of those over at Lake Chelan at Wapato Point because we were, when I was a kid, people didn't look for this much. And there was an old chief over there. His name was Peter Wapato. And he and my dad became friends. And he used to let us go out on Wapato Point and look for things. And we found arrowheads. And we had a fair over there, and we took a board. It was about 4x8, and we attached all this stuff on there of all the stuff that we had. But over the years, we've split them up between the three of us boys, and then a lot of the stuff. There was an old barn up here, and we had a lot of the old stuff out there in the barn, and people would come in and take stuff, and so we ended up with very little stuff, but we do have some pretty neat stuff.
My dad found a mortar, not the pestle part, but the mortar. He was walking on a trail one day, and he kind of half glanced down at the ground and saw just a perfect round stone, and just kept walking, and then kind of went, wait a second, that was one, that's not right. So, turns around and spent an hour and a half looking for the stone that was perfectly round, and found it, and spent another hour and a half digging it out, because it was standing, buried in the ground, just the top.
Isn't this? What area?
I can't remember where he was. It might have been in Medford, Oregon. Not positive, though.
Could be.
Anyway.
We found stuff even in Arizona and places like that. Her sister, one time, was walking up in the hills in Arizona, and there's a perfect arrowhead up there. So it had been shot up there sometime many, many years ago, and just laying there.
Just laying there in the ground. Wow, that's neat.
I've got several. I found an arrowhead right here by the boathouse. It was a beautiful piece of flint. I've never seen like it. It's kind of a amber color.
I've never really found any arrowheads or anything. I've looked for them often, but never found any. So, let's
see. So when you came back from the north, then what happened?
Well, let's see. Come back from Alaska, and when I went up there, at my age, they weren't calling him in the service, but they lowered the age, and I got a year older, so when I come back, they said, either get into something or you'll be drafted in the Army. Well, I didn't want to go in the Army,
So
I joined the Navy Seabees, and that's a construction battalion.
Uh-huh.
And, let's see, we got married, and 8 days later, I signed up for the Seabees, But then it was a little while before I was called, and... So I had to take my basic training back in Virginia. Now here is one of the biggest shocks I ever had in my life. I came from a little town of Manson on Lake Chelan, mm-hmm. and there was no black people or no Mexican. They were all white people in there.
Mm-hmm. And Indians.
And there was one black family in Wenatchee, and they lived down across the railroad tracks. Mm-hmm. And nobody ever hardly saw them, and I'd never seen them. So I go into service. And I'm not a bit prejudiced because I just like people, mm-hmm. and I don't care what color they are, and I'm still that same way today. Well, here's, the first Liberty I went on, we didn't have any black people in our outfit, only the cooks. The cook for the officers were black, and the rest of them, there wasn't a black person in our outfit.
Mm-hmm.
So I go to get on a bus, and I get on the back end of the bus in Virginia, and the bus driver just looked at me, and he just kept looking at me. I said, what's the matter? He says, well, since you move up here, we'll go. We're not going to move. I said, well, why do I have to move up there? He says, the niggers ride in the back. He says, you're no nigger. You ride up front here. And that's just exactly what he said.
Oh, man.
You know? So this is a big shock to me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, after that, I got in the front of the bus, but I don't know. Well, let's see. I did my basic training from there, and the first trip was up in Newfoundland.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to build a port up there, a seaport, because the ships going over to Europe, if they had something wrong, they had to repair them or something. Well, that was a repair station. And there was a big point that run out there, and we had to dump rock. Well, my job was driving truck, and they'd go up in a big quarry where they would blast. They would make tunnels back in, and they'd set a bunch of dynamite and blow up whole mountains, and then they'd load them in there with big old shovels and crane. And that's where I learned to run heavy equipment, too. I run dozers and clamp, stuff like that I learned while I was in there. But then we came back from there, back to Providence, Rhode Island. That's where our main base was then. We stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, that's where Gene and my mom came back to visit me from Manson, rode a bus clear across the United States, if you can remember riding a bus. I'm going to let her tell you about that, too. That's her story. but then I was shipped out to go over to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we landed in England, in Plymouth, England, and had some more training there. And then we were getting ready for the invasion of France. So Omaha Beach was one of the places that they came in. Well, our job was in Plymouth. We built some, they were a cement ship. What they would just make sides on it, and they were square.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd tow them over, and then they towed a whole bunch of ships over. And then we went over after they towed them all over there. Well, they had to make a harbor because Omaha Beach was where they were going to invade,
mm-hmm.
and the Germans had bunkers up on the top of the hill. They just had cement bunkers every place, and then they put things down on the beach. They were things so you couldn't land on a beach.
Uh-huh.
Well, our planes come in and started bombing, and they bombed and bombed till they figured they had the Germans pretty well bombed out up there, and then they bombed the beaches enough that they could knock a lot of this stuff down. So we come in with barges, and great big barges with supplies on it. And our job was to bring supplies into the Army.
Now, so, you would sink those cement things, though, to make the harbor, didn't you?
Well, we made them, but then they bombed the bottom out of them so they would sink.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so they did have a regular harbor there, and then they had a hole through it they could come in with their ships and bring supplies mm-hmm. in. And that's, and when those Omaha Beach, you've maybe seen, they had the 50-year reunion not too long ago and telling about it, and I remember seeing all that stuff. It brings back memories, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was like 4,000 Americans killed. They just kept going up over there and they just slaughtered them, and there's still a great big graveyard up there. Mm-hmm. But when we went in there, why, they were up on top of the hill and going on through, and I've got a book in here about our battalion and all that stuff that tells about all this.
That's when the storm came through there, and and you had to get it, wrecked everything, and you had to get supplies in within so many days.
Just bagged them all up in a terrible storm, terrific winds. But they said if we didn't get supplies coming within 6 days, they'd have to pull out. Mm-hmm. And if they would have, that would have been a complete different war. You know, that things would have happened a lot different. But we got things going back before they figured and got supplies coming in. And, mm-hmm. and we didn't, when we were doing this, we didn't have any hours. You worked as long as you could, mm-hmm. and then you'd sleep. Mm-hmm. And they didn't have any mess halls or anything set up for us, so we'd...
I
remember that when I was a kid, we didn't have pineapple and stuff like that where we lived, because that was, you know, we ate apple. But I remember opening those great big cans of pineapple, take a knife and open it, and take a stick and then run down through the end of those things and eat them. I just love pineapple. Yeah. And but finally they got, you know, they got a camp set up for us and got a cook set up. But he's in the mud. That was the muddiest place I ever saw over there when they got up on top of the hill. And I remember sloshing around that mud and tents. And then you'd take your, you had a little tray that you had to keep, and it all folded up, and you had your knife and fork and spoon on there, and then mm-hmm. you'd take that through the line, and then they'd put stuff on your plate to mm-hmm. eat and stuff like that. It was stuff that they sent in a lot of stuff, you know, mm-hmm. canned stuff, mostly everything canned, nothing fresh.
So what countries did you go through?
Well, let's see. That was in France, but then for occupation, then we went up through Belgium, Holland, and into Germany. Ended up into Germany, Bremerhaven, Germany, mm-hmm. and I remember things about like that. And some of those places, the Germans made a lot of wine, and at that time they called it Guinea Red. That's what they, because it was Italian, and that's what they, that was the terrible nickname that they mm-hmm. called those people. And these soldiers, they would, a lot of times there were a lot of them around, and they'd take their 45s and shoot a hole in the bottom of those great big vats full of wine and put their jerry cans down there, which was a 5-gallon can that they hauled gas in, uh-huh. and fill them full, and everybody fell full and just leave the rest of it, and you'd go in there and wade around in that wine because, you know, in that's what they would drink, be wine. We didn't have too many people that did drink much, you know, when you're young like that. I remember the first time I ever tasted beer, I was 18 years old. Mm-hmm. And I spit it out, thought it was the awfulest taste of stuff there ever was. But, let's see.
Did you have a lot of contact with civilians at all?
Yes.
Did you?
Yeah. Now,
what were their receptions of you? Like, what did they think of you when you came into their country?
Oh, they thought we were great because, mm-hmm. see, even the Germans, they didn't like Hitler and all the things that was going on. Mm-hmm. And they were glad. In fact, when we come through, they would be waving flags and everything, and the kids would come out and want to ride on our vehicles and stuff like that. You know, mm-hmm. it was a great time. When we did go into Bremen, they took pictures from the air, and it was supposed to be all blown up. And we went over there. We had one of the longest convoys that there ever was, with lumber and plumbing and electrical and everything to fix those up, because they want to fix them up for the officers, for officers' quarters. And we got over there, and it was one of the greatest camouflage jobs of the war. They gone up over, and they put they made stuff out of cloth and like that, and looked like it had all been blown up from the air. It looked like it.
Right.
They'd taken pictures. But we got there, we didn't have nothing to do much, so we had lots to eat and very little to do, but just...
You did have a picture of where one side of the street was completely blown up, and the other side there was nothing wrong with it.
They bombed it, and the other side wasn't. And,
even touched, huh?
Yeah. Mm-mm.
Wow.
And the barracks weren't anything, so... Yeah, I've got pictures of an old vehicle that had one wheel that was all bent like that, and it was going down the street with that thing. They took all the vehicles away from the Germans. They took everything, and they had great big warehouses that they put stuff in.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that one thing that they did, they had motorcycles in there. Well, we could take these and ride them, and I rode on the Autobahn, which went from Bremen, Germany, mm-hmm. and that was the first type of a freeway. United States didn't have a freeway at that time,
mm-hmm.
and that's how they come. And I remember I rode this, is a BMW motorcycle, and it had a sidecar on it. I remember that,
mm-hmm.
and I rode that out on the freeway. Just
that's so
I learned to. That's where I learned to. Of course, I rode a bicycle all the time. And
mm-hmm.
Maybe I should tell you about the bicycle when I was at Manson when I was a kid. Why my first bicycle cost me $5,
mm-hmm.
and I really liked that bicycle because that way, instead of going down to Manson, instead of walking, I could ride my bicycle down there and back.
Mm-hmm.
And so I rode it for a while, and then I saved up enough money. Of course, us kids, nobody gave us money in those days. If mm-hmm. you wanted money, you worked for it. And I sent to Chicago to the Mead Cycle Company, and the bicycle was a Columbia. And it cost me $39, mm-hmm. and they shipped it down to Chelan Falls. It was in a crate, and I went down there, which is about 16 miles from Manson, down over a big hill, and I put it together, and I rode it home up mm-hmm. over the steep hills, and I used to ride that bicycle all over, you know, going to school. And one time I rode it from Manson down to Wenatchee to the Apple Blossom Festival,
mm-hmm.
and that was how many miles would be?
50
miles.
Oh my
yeah,
goodness.
Rode my bicycle 50
and
miles.
Back.
No, I didn't ride it back. I got somebody bring it back because it was be late at night, and mm-hmm. and the old cars at that time had running boards on it, and you'd put it on the running board. I used to put my arm out to
hold it
so it wouldn't fall off.
Wow, 50 miles.
Yeah. Well, there's people today that ride long distances, like
insane.
Jerry Lewis. Do you know Jerry Lewis here on the island?
I don't.
He's a runner, walker, bicycle rider, mm-hmm. and he rides maybe 3,000 miles now, something like that. I mean, just terrific things he does. So my little full time wasn't anything compared to what he used to do.
So then after... Where were we at? We were through France now?
Let's see. After the war, we all came home after the war. Well, you know, we weren't expected to live at home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, anyway, that's how I went to work at Boeing's. And
no. That was before.
That was before. Okay.
We're in the wrong time period here.
All right. And afterwards...
We went to Manson and you worked in the orchard.
Yeah, I worked in the orchard. Oh, yeah. I worked for a man out in these orchards. And I was his, right-hand man. He used to let me run the orchards and everything like that. And picking mm-hmm. fruits. Picking apples then was quite a thing. You know, you had to use ladders and... Mm-hmm. Set ladders and you pick them, and this is before bins. They just had apple boxes, and you pick and sack on. And I used to pick around 300 or 400 boxes of apples a day, which is an awful lot of apples.
Mm-hmm.
Stack them up and haul them out.
Then he'd put his application in at McNeil.
Yeah, somebody told me when I got out of the service, my parents had moved here on Anderson Island. Well, I didn't know where Anderson Island was, but I finally found it,
mm-hmm.
and then I saw that big old smokestacks, and I asked the deckhand over there, I said, what kind of a factory? He says, well, that's a prison. That's a federal prison. So, because I had worked up in the Yukon, and they said that when you got out of the service, you could get your old job back. Well, they didn't have that job. It was gone.
Mm-hmm.
But it was civil service, so I was looking around, and I thought, well, I'll go to work over there just temporary because I didn't think I wanted to work in a prison. So I went to work there temporary, and when I retired in 26 years later, why, I told him then, I said, I told you. Well, in fact, I told him I was going to, my boss was going to retire. He said, no, you're too young. You're only 50. People don't retire at 50. And so I went ahead and retired. So they gave me a little, made cake and stuff for it. So I said, okay, I told you when I come here, I'm going to just work here temporarily. And so this is my temporary. I'm through. I quit.
That's funny.
So that was when I was 50 years old. And the only thing I've done since then is sit and rock. And I did go to work over in the orchards for a short time because I wanted to get enough for Medicare too. See, I had, I have civil service, so we have insurance through them, and then mm-hmm. I have Medicare. So we're insured for everything mm-hmm. pretty well for insurance purposes. But let's see, then.
How many siblings do you have exactly?
Well,
three brothers.
In the family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Larry, the oldest one's dead, and that's mm-hmm. his wife up here. And we have two grandsons. Mm-hmm. So we think our Gordons are coming to an end fast mm-hmm. because we have Joe. Mm-hmm. She's never gonna get married. Jim has the two kids, and Wayne. Let's see, Wayne don't want kids, and Warren can't have kids. Mm-hmm. So so we got Chemo, that he's married to a lady that's got kids, and Kalakaua says he's never going to get married, never going to have kids.
That's our grandsons.
Yeah, our grandsons. Uh-huh.
Chemo and Kalakaua.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're Hawaiian. And real neat people. That's completely funny. Opposites. Don't get along. And some of them don't get along with their parents, and some of them do.
No.
But we get along with everybody. So now where are we?
Well, at McNeil, you worked every job. You worked in the hospital, the control room. You worked in the control room longer than anybody else ever did. And then you went out to the farm and
did the rest of my, I think I did nine, I don't know, 6-9 years in the
9 years, yeah.
And most of that time is the control room, which is the control center for everything. You have to open and close gates, and you have to make up all the counts. I remember that you have to count prisoners about 3 or 4 times a day. Mm-hmm. And if they're at noon, they're out on the job, but they blow a whistle, so everybody comes in at noon, and then they're counted, mm-hmm. and then they go to the dining room and eat. And then in the morning and evening, they're in their cells, but some of them have jobs, but everybody has to send in the count. In the control room, you have to write all these things down. I wish I'd saved some of those pieces of paper where everybody worked and then total them up. And it had to come out exactly the same as your count. Mm-hmm. If you come out wrong, then there's somebody missing.
Mm-hmm.
And while I did work there, nobody had ever escaped from the island that we knew of that had lived. There were a couple of them that they think had probably drowned or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I'd been out on quite a few escapes. They had what they called post number one, and that was out at Lure Creek, which is still called Lure Creek. And there was an old house at John Lure that bought this place that my folks bought from us from John Lure.
Uh-huh.
And that's where I'd go when there'd be an escape. And,
how many escapes were?
We didn't have too many in those days. And one thing that they didn't furnish you any gun or anything either. Now they had they'd send you out in groups, and the group leader would have a gun. And one time that they were looking for these two guys, and they couldn't find them. And so another fellow and I, we decided there was what they called a calf barn there, and there was a kind of a barn that had hay in it. Mm-hmm. So we walked up in the hay, and people had just been through there, and we went up there, and there's up top there was some loose hay up there. And I remember the guy I was with, he just reached down like that, and here's these two faces looking up at him. It had been raining, and it was wintertime, it was cold, and they'd taken their clothes off and was down there trying to keep warm, covered up with hay because they knew he was looking for him. News was all around there.
Uh-huh.
So we got him up out of there. We had big old heavy raincoats on, so we put him on them, not uh-huh. to keep them dry, as to keep something heavy on them so if they decided to run, because we didn't have
right.
any gun.
Right.
And here we are. I had a orange in my pocket, and I told him, I put my hand in my pocket. I said, "Now I've got a gun on you, so you better not run." So they could see this thing in my pocket, but it wasn't. So we got up here to where the rest of the guy was, and we had these two guys, and all of a sudden this guy with a gun, he come over, and man, he started firing shots and got all. I said, "Now wait a minute, you know, we've already got him." So anyway, they took over then and mm-hmm. took him in and locked him up.
Wow.
That was probably...
So the newspaper wanted to do the reenactment.
Yeah.
And so they said the public won't believe he didn't have guns. They made him
have
what'd you have, carbines or something?
Yeah. to reenact this thing.
Wow. That's funny. Shoot, I had a question. I can't remember. Well, the reason why wouldn't they give you guns is because it was a federal prison at that point?
Well, we didn't. You know, the only guns that they had was in the towers.
Uh-huh.
And they don't like to have guns around because somebody took your gun away from you.
Right.
Know?